We want to smash, crash, bash, mash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear, we ain't scared, this is the vision we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today on the program, as we approach the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, we'll take a look at civil liberties abridgments and ongoing struggles to protect them in the wake of that fateful day. We'll start the program in discussion with Ken Jenkins, the organizer of this year's annual 9/11 Film Festival at the Grand Lake Theater. Ken Jenkins, longtime 9/11 truth activist and filmmaker, will talk to us about psychological aspects of 9/11 and how to overcome emotional barriers to 9/11 truth. Later on the program, we're joined by attorney and executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Shahid Batar. We'll talk about civil rights abridgments post-9/11. We end the show with filmmaker Robbie Martin of Media Roots. He'll talk about his film, American Anthrax. Please stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today, we focus on 9/11 and 9/11 related issues. We'll be focusing a good part of the program on civil liberties issues in the wake of 9/11 with Shahid Batar. And I will be rounding out the program with Media Roots' Robbie Martin on his American Anthrax film. But we begin the program today talking with longtime 9/11 activist, filmmaker, Ken Jenkins. Ken Jenkins has done work on psychological aspects of 9/11, how to overcome emotional barriers to 9/11 truth. But he is also a longtime involved as organizer, co-organizer of the annual 9/11 Film Festival that's held in Oakland, California at the Grand Lake Theater. That event will be taking place on 9/11, literally on the day 9/11. It will be streaming live at nolizradio.org. So even if people don't live in the San Francisco Bay Area, cannot make it to that event, they can tune in at nolizradio.org. Ken Jenkins, you join us today by phone.
Hi there, Mickey. Great to be with you.
Ken Jenkins, thanks so much for being with us. It's that time of year when we're gearing up to remind people about what we maybe don't know about the events of 9/11. Certainly, our politicians and corporate media love to invoke 9/11 for a myriad purposes to stoke fear and so forth. But you've long been involved dealing with 9/11 truth in particular, and the psychological aspects and emotional barriers to 9/11 truth. I think that's a good place for us to start, having you tell us a little bit about your research and your work.
All right. Well, yeah, I started, of course, just researching the information to discover that the official story simply couldn't be true. But within a year or two, I started realizing that the biggest challenge wasn't the information, which is abundant and clear if one's willing to look at it, but rather the psychological resistance that most of us have to even wanting to look at this kind of information basically makes us uncomfortable emotionally. And so that's been kind of one of my specialties, is looking at, you know, what are those resistances, why are they there, and what can we do to overcome them. And I looked, of course, at myself in terms of my own resistance as well. I was first looking at these questions. It was very hard for me to believe that something of this magnitude could be pulled off and gotten away with. It really took me a couple months of research, pretty much right after the event, before I became fully convinced. So when I got into this psychological aspect, I started with myself and, well, what was my own resistance? And you and your viewers probably know of the idea of the big lie, that if you tell a lie big enough, that it's hard for most people to believe it's outside of their normal day-to-day experience. And so it becomes a kind of a surreal notion that some of that magnitude could happen. But that was my resistance, I realized in retrospect. And we all have our own individual resistances. And so I have spoken on it and actually written an article called The Truth Is Not Enough, which basically looks at a whole series of resistances. And in a film that the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth have put out called Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out, they actually have a 15-minute part of that film that is with various psychologists talking about the resistance. And their primary point, which I think is totally valid, is that for most people, resistance has to do with the 9/11 truth issue kind of confronting us with a worldview change. It causes us to be forced to look at the world in a different way and change our worldview. And that's probably the biggest single category of resistance, is this idea of a change of worldview.
Ken, hi, this is Peter Phillips. Good to have you on. You've been having these 9/11 film festivals now, what, 12 years?
Well, film festivals formally for about 9.
This is at the Grand Lake Theater, and we're really happy to know that anybody that hears this show can go online and see the entire program, which is like a 8-hour, 10-hour program that day on 9/11 through NoLivesRadio.org. What is going to be presented that's new? I know there's a film on Anthrax, and we're going to be talking to Robbie Martin later. What else is new coming forward here? I mean, 9/11 is a massive issues and misinformation, a lot of counter-information from various sources, including the Central Intelligence Agency and others, labeling anybody that asks these questions, you know, conspiracy theorists and, you know, are mentally ill or whatever. And that, of course, is a big psychological deterrent as well. What's new this year that you're going to be having at the festival?
Well, the main featured film we have in the evening, the title is The Anatomy of a Great Deception. And actually, it ties right in with what we were just talking about, the psychological thing. And if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to read a sentence or two from the description of that film that speaks directly to that. Dave got involved with the 9/11 work rather recently, David Hooper, the filmmaker. And what he's basically saying is that when he got into the information that shows that the official story simply couldn't be true, it caused him a lot of emotional upheaval. So he writes, besides the emotional upheaval that he felt because of the belief that his government betrayed him, he also felt isolated from family and friends who shared neither his convictions nor his conviction that America had been lied to. And so he says the film was produced in order to help inspire friends and family and the general public to see the world from his perspective of what happened that day. And that's part of the challenge, that it's not only a matter of going through our own change of worldview and our own looking at this event and how the world works, really, in a very different way, but also there's a tendency in many cases to find oneself alienated from friends and family to even talk about this stuff. And so that film we're very excited about, because it's not just about the information that we've presented many times over the years, but it's about one person's journey getting into this and the difficulties he encountered.
Ken, we've all been following various research on 9/11 for a number of years, some of it pretty difficult to accept, and then some very, very concerning, with contradictions certainly from the 9/11 Commission report. In your mind, besides the collapse of the Building 7, what do you think is probably one of the biggest issues that is still left unresolved?
Well, for me, besides the towers, as you point out, which is a big one, the one that got to me right away, and I find that many people were aware of either on the day or got noticed, was a big kind of gap in the official story, was the lack of the military response, the normal Air Force fighter jets that would be scrambled anytime any airplane is off course or not responding to radio contact and so forth. That happened with 4 different planes over a period of an hour and 40 minutes, where normal response time is in the 10 to 15 minute range. And you know, even on the day, I wasn't paying that much attention, but I did notice that, and a lot of people did, and kind of scratched their heads and wonder, you know, where the heck are the fighter jets? And that remains a huge question because of, as I said, the big difference in time between normal response that happens roughly 100 times a year.
Your point is that there is yet again a long list of unanswered questions. And I always like to point out to folks, having taught a course on this for about a decade, even though there are a lot of folks, as you say, have an aversion, or as I like to say, have an allergy to some of the 9/11 questions and emotional barriers and so forth, I always like to point out John Farmer, the dean of law at Rutgers University, who was involved as senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission. And even though people may argue about the efficacy of what he puts forth in his book, The Ground Truth, and people clearly have disagreed, one thing was clear, and that's Farmer said, quote, "The public has been seriously misled about what occurred during the morning of the attacks, and that at some level of government, at some point in time, there was an agreement not to tell the truth about what happened," end quote. So given that we have these types of statements from people that are oft-touted by the establishment, one should be able to rest on at least the possible conclusion that we just don't know some of these things.
Yeah, absolutely. That particular quote, and John Farmer, of course, is not considered a truther or a person as part of the 9/11 truth movement. He's much more a part of the establishment. And yet he is saying, you know, pretty powerful statements that there's something seriously wrong with the official story. And that alone, coming from him, should be a motivation to look into it.
Indeed, Ken Jenkins. Could you kindly tell our listeners where they can find information about this year's festival and a little bit the times of the festival and so forth? Certainly Project Censored will be there, and we hope people in the audience that are interested in these affairs will come.
Yeah, we're glad that you're going to be there again this year. The film festival itself is at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, and our website to find out more information is SF, as in San Francisco, sf911truth.org. And all the information's there. You can even click from there, or shortly you'll be able to, and buy tickets. The start time is 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a long festival going all the way till 11 at night. And we're going to start right at 1 o'clock with our first film, which is actually another new one, 5-hour-long film. We'll be showing about 4.5 hours of it in three parts, so there'll be breaks. Don't worry about that. Trying to watch that in one sitting. But in any event, that'll be starting at 1, and then the film I just mentioned will be on in the evening. And as it was also mentioned earlier, if you're out of the Bay Area, we do invite you to come to the theater, but if you're not in the Bay Area, for some reason you can't make it, it is the entire film festival, all the films will be streamed live online with No Lies Radio at nolizeradio.org.
Ken Jenkins, thank you so much for joining us today on the Project Censored Show, and we look forward to seeing you and everyone else at the film festival at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California by Lake Merritt next Thursday, September 11th. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, both of you.
After this musical break, we'll be joined by Shahid Batar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and we'll be talking about civil rights in the post-9/11 era. Stay with us.
NSA breaks the law every day. It doesn't matter who you are or what you say. They monitor your phone calls and emails anyway. Corrupt Congress and courts paving the way. There's a lesson you'll learn someday. Watch what you say. See, they spy on your mind, record your calls for posterity, commit daily executive crimes with impunity. They're the authorities here to keep us safe until the boot ends up on your face. Against the Constitution, we the people are the ones our government is abusing. We can force any agency to make a new choice when we build a movement, each raising our voice. They lie about the origins of the evidence. They lie about the numbers of Americans watched. Immense, too large for them to calculate, they sigh. A self-serving lie by the government side. Computing power unmatched in history. Presuming the power to wiretap humanity. It's insanity how large the hubris looms. The government's watching you in the bathroom. And they lie about it at every opportunity. Sustained abuses of every community. Unity across Washington, D.C. All three branches against the people we see. Bush signed a secret presidential decree. Obama talked a big game. The presidentially did everything he could to entrench the Bush legacy. A complex composed of military industry. Eisenhower 60 years before anticipated it'd be rising in the ranks for generations, growing. A crisis in democracy, sowing the futures at stake. You could start by knowing. Is the NSA against the Constitution? We the people are the ones our government is abusing. We can force any agency to make a new choice when we build a movement, each raising our voice. 100 years since World War I, the FBI versus free speech has held a gun. Constitutional rights on the run. The Pomeranz, the first, but not the last one. Fast forward 40 years to the real Red Scare. McCarthy didn't number, but the FBI was there. They were everywhere. They knew what you were to bed. They prosecuted people for the thoughts in our heads. What does it mean to monitor thoughts? Spying means a lot more than watching what you bought. It's the feds always knowing what you've got in your head. Not only whoever with whom you share your bed, but whether you're compliant or a threat instead ahead, like MLK to be neutralized. The word the FBI used decades of lies exposed, revealed as institutionalized.
The Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. We are now joined by Shahid Batar. He is a civil rights lawyer, hip-hop and electronica MC, independent columnist, nonprofit leader, grassroots community organizer, singer and poet. Did I also mention he's executive director at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, one of my favorite organizations? Shahid, thank you for joining us live in studio.
Thanks so much for having me on, Mickey. It's a pleasure to be here.
Shahid, what are you doing in the Bay Area? You're always doing something related to protecting, defending our civil liberties. Had a great time at a panel in the Russell Senate building with you, Project Censored, and you were there with Government Accountability Project and others for the National Whistleblower Summit. And I recall some of the things that you were talking about there and, you know, really hitting on are obviously things that you're likely still working on. Maybe we could start with some of that.
Sure. Yeah. Unfortunately, these issues have very long timelines. And in fact, I remember that appearance, I think, came about after the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board had not a formal hearing, but essentially a public comment opportunity to discuss various issues in front of it, including the NSA dragnet. And at that meeting, I tried to explain to the board that what Congress, what the press, what we, the public, know about the NSA dragnet, about CIA torture and the resulting cover-up, about police militarization, most of it is secret. We know very little. What we know are simply pinpricks in blankets of institutional secrecy. And secrecy begets abuse. And I dare say that recipe resembles corruption. And in the intelligence community, whether we're talking about the FBI, the NSA, the CIA, name your agency, there are problems at all of them. And the ones at the NSA and the CIA are particularly profound. In the context of that appearance, we were just talking about transparency, which is a baseline value, right? That should unite anyone left and right. And it's really interesting to see even those very widely shared values across the political continuum so blatantly disregarded and sullied.
Shahid, when you say NSA, Dragnet, talk a little bit more about what that means. We know that the government's spying on us and using the internet and social programs. But what do we know about this?
What we've learned from the Snowden disclosures, the various parts of the iceberg, right, that have peaked out, what we've learned is that the government is watching the internet and the phone system, and anything you say, hear, read, or write is monitored. They're at least available to be monitored by the government. A lot of it is collected beyond what would make any sense to national security purposes. And the particular problem, which most people overlook, is that well beyond a privacy invasion and well beyond a violation of democratic transparency principles, what we're talking about here with mass surveillance, untethered from individual suspicion, is the threat to freedom of thought. The relationship between privacy for individuals and dissent in a society is one that I think a lot of casual observers of these issues forget. The reason I'm concerned about mass surveillance is because it's the nail in the coffin on democracy. It's the tool through which a future government, or president less thoughtful than this one, or even for that matter, just any jackass in the prosecutorial chain of command, can subvert democracy. And that's the fear.
Well, this is also systemic, dating back to 9/11. Of course, in the history of the United States, we can go way back to civil liberty abridgments, 1798, Aliens Edition.
Sure, the Pomerays.
We can stroll through. It's a sad state of affairs and a sad narrative, to be sure. But certainly after 9/11, that has routinely been invoked as the reason why we must... First, we were relentlessly lied to about the data collection, the spying, the torture, and the quietness of 1033 and the militarization of the police state, so forth. And the constitutioncampaign.org, the blog for Bill of Rights Defense Committee, right?
Yep.
BORDC.org.
That's right.
So listeners certainly should check those websites out. One of the most recent pieces on here, government surveillance in public spaces. And we've seen in Tacoma and a number of other places where police are wheeling out these portable data collectors.
Yep.
And I mean, this is massive. This is beyond even just NSA. This is becoming a routine part of our system of,
absolutely.
Of living.
At the local level, too, which is important to recognize. I think a lot of people see the NSA and the CIA, and there's plenty of blame to go around those agencies, and it's very challenging to know what to do about them because they're federal agencies that answer only to Congress and lie to courts and Congress and get away with it all the time and are rewarded with budget increases and more powers. And what do you do as an individual? And the answer there is to act locally. And it's easy to do that because these issues have a local face. I was talking at a forum here in Berkeley with about 50 people about a proposal by the Berkeley Police Department to get tasers. And this was prompted apparently by a particular attack on a particular Berkeley police officer. It was a very unfortunate, tragic incident. And, what lost in the discussion is the fact that tasers don't actually help situations like that, right? If an officer faces a threat to his or her safety, they're trained to shoot. And there's this pretension that tasers are non-lethal when, in fact, 1,000 people have died from police tasers over the course of their use. That doesn't sound so non-lethal to me. One of the pieces that I found most inspiring was the presence of a whole series of co-sponsoring organizations. On the panel was the NAACP, which has a very clear interest, right, in keeping the police from having tasers given the way that profiling is pervasive across police departments. There was a representative from Palo Alto, a former public defender, who talked about the way tasers had been used on his clients, a civil rights attorney here in Berkeley, Jim Channon and myself. And it was interesting to see so many different community groups turn out to support that work. And I think that's the answer to how we disentangle the national security control state, is to take off one scale at a time. And, as I said to the crowd, I'm really proud of Berkeley, California, for being in so many different ways a leader with respect to that. And San Francisco, you would hope, would follow not far behind. But for better or worse, I dare say, most of the communities in this area have yet to adopt some of the local civil rights protections that Berkeley has.
And unfortunately, by the way, we're speaking with Shahid Batar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. You can learn more at BORDC.org. You can check out their blog, constitutioncampaign.org, where there's also a piece on 538 people killed by tasers in the last decade plus. And again, part of the issue to which you were addressing, this is a lethal, non-lethal form of suppressing certain communities and so forth. And Shahid, you're telling our listeners also that fighting on the local level is really a place to go. Sadly, we don't see some of those struggles escalate until there is a tragedy
right
in the community.
Well, and to be honest, most of the time that there is a tragedy in the community, instead of the struggle escalating, you know, we waste our time responding to a discrete incident instead of demanding things to prevent the next set of them. What happened in Ferguson, Missouri, for instance, is tragic, unfortunate. It is terrible. None of us should take it laying down. And quite frankly, we shouldn't limit our concerns to Ferguson, because that stuff happens everywhere. Is there any community in the United States where a low-income black community can assertively represent its interests? And I don't think the answer is yes. I mean, that set of affairs would repeat itself anywhere.
For the last several hundred years, that answer has been the same. In the United States, and then even in the colonies.
Absolutely. And Congress has done nothing to fix it. The Obama administration certainly hasn't. I mean, both of those sets of institutions have been entirely complicit in the paramilitarization of the police. And just to, you know, expand the frame a little bit, one of the things, I'll try to connect the dots here between what we were talking about before and what came up in the Taser forum. One of my points is that tasers are not unlike CIA drones insofar as there are official lies that justify using them in the face of documented evidence that goes to the contrary. For CIA drones, it looks like this. There's this claim that they're targeted, that they minimize civilian casualties. You can use a drone instead of a nuclear bomb or a drone instead of a cluster bomb, and you only kill the target. You don't kill everyone around them, except that the only independent analysis of the data by NYU and Stanford concluded that something like 90% of the victims of drone strikes are, in fact, innocents. So they're not so particularly targeted. You know, tasers are presented as non-lethal. You look at the evidence, you know, the 500 number you cited was just in the last decade. You go back into the 80s and the number climbs up to 1,000. Last night I learned that there are a whole series of medical diagnoses invented by police departments to explain taser-related deaths without chalking them up to tasers. Like, for instance, one of them was sudden in-custody death syndrome. It's preposterous, right?
It sounds like The Onion.
Yeah, well, right. And all of this would be farcical were it not true. That's what's so disturbing about it. You can't invent fiction this preposterous.
Well, we know that about 800 people a year die in local jails, usually within the first week, and various sorts of rationales are presented for that. We also know that close to 700 on an annual basis die in law enforcement-related deaths around the country, and Ferguson is certainly one example, but that's going on daily all over.
That's roughly one 9/11 every 2 years.
Exactly.
Right.
But then the breakdown, I mean, we know that there's this giant data collection center being built in Utah, that NSA is and the CIA, everybody's feeding information, all the electronic communications, telephone calls, cell phone calls, everything is being assembled there. And we had Nafisa Ahmed on last week who was talking about the research being done to identify through keywords radicals or potential radicals and start to build lists of people. Now, we're also researching, working on a story right now, whereby local police have access to a Google-type search engine inside of this kind of data so that they can research, and this won't be available to the public at all,
right,
but they can research and communicate through their fusion centers information on anybody in their own jurisdictions. So that empowers the police. Not only are they being militarized with tanks and weapons of war, but it empowers them with data information that they can selectively pick potential or possible radicals, or people who might commit a crime kind of thing. I mean, we're not far from profiling people in terms of potential criminality.
Oh, I mean, we're talking about profiling people according to ideology. Even worse, I think I was just in Salt Lake less than a month ago at another event mobilizing a progressive libertarian alliance to challenge through the state legislature the access of the NSA's data facility to the water and electrical resources it needs to operate. And this is another piece I think is important for your listeners to recognize. You don't have to wait for Congress to fix these problems. There are any number of ways to pull levers in our federal system. One of them is the state legislatures. California's has been not bad on a lot of these issues, and Utah's has an opportunity to particularly protect the civil rights of its residents by challenging the access to the public resources that the NSA has claimed. The NSA facility in Bluffdale is not only going to facilitate mass surveillance, the suppression of dissent, and everything else we're talking about, it's also going to suck up 1.5 million gallons of water every day in a desert with a climate change problem, which is to say, you know, we have...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's why you have libertarians and environmentalists who of course, rarely see eye to eye, coming together to demand some accountability. And I think that's the key, is to act locally across our communities in ways that we can build meaningful power only when we act in concert with people who don't look like us, people who don't necessarily share our concerns. And that only happens locally, because at the national level, everyone has their respective agenda. So the most important, most powerful thing someone can do, if you share these concerns or any others, is to meet people, make introductions, raise your voice, and organize ways together to do that in concert. That's how we've gotten everything we've ever gotten in this country. Civil rights, women's suffrage, the Clean Water Act, you name it.
We're speaking to Shahid Batar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and you just mentioned water. This is to cool servers.
Cool the servers, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and California, of course, is in a record drought. So local to global warming and so forth, there's a lot of places to have these alliances beyond, moving beyond the right-left paradigms. And, of course, Ralph Nader's recent book talking about building some of these kinds of other libertarian right-left and progressive alliances and so forth, specifically on these key issues like civil liberties. You've been traveling all over for some time, and it sounds to me like you have some very positive examples of the way that local communities are at least starting to get together and make these things happen.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, at the macro sphere, the federal level, the picture is very dark and grim. You know, even despite the Snowden revelations, it's a year and several months later, and very little has changed in Washington. The Obama administration has made some very meager concessions in the operations of the NSA's dragnet. This is the 3 versus 2 hops stretch, but you can still get to everyone in the country through 2 hops. And meanwhile, Congress is debating a compromised version of the USA Freedom Act, which, you know, in some respects could do more harm than good. It's very confusing at the moment to see what shred of legitimacy remains in the debate. And I'll put it to you this way. When the members of Congress who wrote the Patriot Act found out from Edward Snowden, who they refused to invite to testify in Congress, when they found out from Edward Snowden how their bill was being used, they wrote a bill to stop it. And when you have whistleblowers informing Congress about things that they should be learning about in hearings, that is an indication that there is a problem. When it takes a year and a half for a whistleblower, after informing Congress, to get any kind of hearing, and it still hasn't happened, that's corruption. And that's what we're dealing with. It's more than a policy issue. We're talking about an entrenched establishment with allies across each of the corporate political parties insulating itself from a sustained grassroots critique that, you know, started well before even 9/11, and you could see it most recently through the Occupy movement, before that through the Tea Party. There is sustained rage across the grassroots continuum among Americans, and we have yet to see the government respond to it at the local level. Tons of momentum. I could tell a great story from Asheville, North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina, any number of towns in Western Massachusetts who have taken affirmative steps to protect civil rights and ensure civil rights protections above the federal floor. That's the point, is the federal system represents not the limit of what you can do as a local community, but the very baseline. And any community has available to it any number of further protections, and we're happy to work with anybody in adopting some of those wherever your listeners might live.
And at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee website, you've listed the over 400 communities and so forth that have voted against the Patriot Act, specifically Section 215 and others, library compliance records. And
all that was before Snowden.
Yes, it was.
Right.
And you mentioned something, though, in passing, and kind of blew by, and I'd like to return to that. You mentioned the USA Freedom Act.
Yeah.
Could you tell our listeners, what exactly is that?
So the USA Freedom Act was written by the authors of the Patriot Act, particularly to restrain the phone system surveillance, so notably excluding protections for the internet. It was essentially pulled off the shelf after the Snowden revelations because it was Senator Leahy's previous attempt to restrain Patriot Act abuses, and it didn't make it through the Senate when it was first introduced. And after the Snowden leaks, people thought that maybe it has a shot to move now. There's a much stronger bill that remains under the bus called the Surveillance State Repeal Act. I'll set that aside for a minute. What happened to the USA Freedom Act is a perfect case study for what's wrong in Washington. So it starts moving through the House Judiciary Committee, where it gets a bipartisan, I believe, unanimous approval. It surprisingly passes the House Intelligence Committee, which had its own bill, which would have been very sharply defensive of the NSA, would really derailed reform efforts. And after passing 2 congressional committees, on the eve of its passage by the House of Representatives, who might team up to derail the bill by rewriting its central definitions and making it a vehicle to more surveillance? It was the Democratic White House, controlled by President Barack Obama, in tandem with the Republican leadership of the House of Representatives. So these are people who are partisan, inimical opponents.
Yeah, the Clinton-Gingrich redux.
Yes. And they come together around what? The issues against which we the people are most aligned. And that's an indication of the depth of the political process problem in which we find ourselves. You know, I remind people a lot when we talk about these issues that these are not analogous to policy fights. This is not similar to a tax struggle or a zoning struggle. You know, what we're talking about here is ultimately the closest analogs we have as we look to historical examples are struggles to reclaim democracy in dictatorships, because that's what we're talking about here. You can vote for change all you want. Detention, torture, surveillance are all worse
now. In a plutocratic oligarchy, that's irrelevant.
Exactly. No, you nailed it. And in an oligarchy, how do you assert influence? And it's very much through shifting the cultural baseline. And that's what creating a discourse and using local levers to force state legislatures and Congress to take positions, to force action, to initiate in the face of institutional deference to these abuses. That's the opportunity available to us.
Mm-hmm. So certainly community policing and citizen review boards and democracy at a local level inside of city councils and boards of supervisors is something that is very vital in the context of how these are implemented on a local scale. If a city gets a tank, sometimes people are like, oh my God, what do we need a tank for?
That got proposed here in Berkeley 3 years ago until
right.
a grassroots coalition
fended
it off.
Sonoma County.
And
there's always a justification, you know, that those justifications not only encroach upon civil liberties in a variety of ways. There's continued justification. Of course, corporate media amplifies those justifications. But what we're really dealing with here is an understanding that our personal cognitive liberty is at risk.
Cognitive liberty. That's a great term to capture it. I think that's exactly right.
And that we're really faced with being propagandized so much and controlled so much and watched that not only will we become afraid to speak out on issues, but what we can think is managed and controlled all the way from literally the local police up. And that is a liberty issue of our ability to think.
And I think, you know, unfortunately, we've crossed both those Rubicons, right? What we hear is already managed, except to the extent that we actively avail ourselves, you know, through tools that are watched like the internet of alternative sources. And, you know, similarly, a lot of people are already afraid to speak out. You know, I speak every day, particularly, you know, the classic example I would cite are government contractors. There's a whole community of people in D.C. who are technologists who have grave concerns with what's happening. All of them pay their rent by working for the government, and none of them feel entitled to raise their voice, and with good reason. And that's just one community. In academics, there have been all kinds of restrictions on academic freedom. You know, I think about Ward mm-hmm. Churchill being fired despite having tenure from the University of Colorado for having a politically incendiary analysis.
Well, this has happened at the University of Illinois, or the issue of Palestine and the bombing of Gaza. I mean, this is ongoing. Well, by the way, we'll have Greg Lukianoff on the next Project Censored show from the fire. Talking about academic freedom, this
perfect.
Is again an issue. You're right. I'm sad that I find myself agreeing with everything you're saying, Shahid Batar.
It's a sad state of affairs. But I don't think it's all doom and gloom, because I do think some of those positive examples, you know, whether it's the whistleblowers offering the pinpricks in mm-hmm. the blanket of secrecy, whether it's the local communities like Berkeley, like Asheville, North Carolina, that are. And I do want to unpack this. How a community restrains police is very critical. And New York offers a great example of this. You know, it's the country's largest city. It has the world's seventh largest army, is the NYPD. It's larger than every army in the world except for six others. Of course, one of them being the U.S., China, Russia, and a handful of others. But we have to gather the scale. You know, the NYPD has international operations. They've got agents doing undercover operations all through the Middle East. Like, they run their own intelligence operation. It's a vast, vast...
We've seen that with the mosque crawlers and so forth, their infiltration of Muslim communities.
College campuses, yep,
right.
Exactly. So, you know, last year, in 2013, the people of New York not only ganged up on the NYPD, wrestled it politically to the ground, won a pretty crucial reform to establish some independent oversight in the city council, overrode the mayor's veto, and then kicked the mayor out of office all over these issues. And if that can happen in New York, where the police have, you know, at least as much political force as they do anywhere else in the world, it can happen anywhere. And the way it happened in New York was African-Americans, Latinos, immigrants, Muslims, mm-hmm. gay people, and homeless people marching together in the street. Literally, that was the coalition.
And resisting stop and frisk.
And right, connecting Carl. Stop and frisk
yep,
to surveillance.
Right.
And it's interesting, you know, here in the Bay Area, the only place that's really happened is the East Bay. And the city, you know, the advocacy networks, for whatever reason, are very parochial. And, you know, they choose to isolate their issues and mobilize their own communities. And that's a quick way to make sure you don't get any influence. Like, the only way to establish power, to overcome entrenched institutions, is to mobilize various sectors of the community. That's how you get through the, you know, for instance, these justifications that Peter was talking about, whether for the tanks or the drones or the next ones that are going to be coming up. You know, the last time I was in the Bay, I was speaking at a forum on the use of police drones. And in the face of those justifications, what sways public officials is not rational argument. It's when they see so many different groups of their constituents before them that they realize if they vote along with the corporate or police interest here, they will find themselves out of a job, right? And the only way that happens is when the groups reach out, coordinate, educate their bases. Outreach, mobilization equals impact. And it takes outreach in addition to mobilization. And one other thing, I mean, I'm kind of ranting here, but I think another thing worth noting for your listeners, especially the ones who share our concerns and are frustrated, we have at least three obstacles, and they're worth identifying and making explicit because they each require different remedies. The first one is ignorance, which is why information is so important, what you guys are doing at Project Censored is so critical, is to fight through the veil of ignorance, and that affects even the members of the press in Congress, right? The second is apathy, because even a lot of people who know what's happening could not care less. And in the face of apathy, we have to introduce concern. And some of that is about explaining, for instance, that the NSA isn't just invading your privacy. They're making sure that your kids can't have independent thoughts, right? So it's addressing ignorance, apathy, and the final one is resignation. Because even if you have the information, even if you care, you might not know what to do with these leviathans breathing down our necks and with their hands around our throats. And the key there is hope. And it's one of the reasons I think that the president's campaign was so disappointing, because he pimped a value that's much more important than any politician.
Well, co-option. I mean, that's...
Indeed.
So,
yeah.
Given all of this, if we do not have a grassroots mobilization against control in our lives at a local level, all the way up, the direction that we're moving looks pretty ominous. What would it be like, perhaps, 10 years from now, with no restrictions? Where would NSA like to go? I mean, literally everything we do, see, think, know, put together in one big database so they can profile anybody, drones looking in your windows. I mean, yeah. Where are we? What kind of a...
How dystopic are we going to get?
You just invoked the word I was going to go to. I mean, there's literature depictions of this kind of scenario, and that's all we really have to go on, other than the historical examples of life behind the Iron Curtain. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth making that explicit for Americans, too. You know, we thought we won the Cold War. We lost the Cold War to ourselves.
Which may not have ended...
Indeed.
Anyway, certainly it both
well,
domestic and foreign.
Reinventing the Cold War.
It's being reprised now, at least.
Right.
Only it's not so cold anymore.
global warming worse. Yeah. Look, there's a lot of stuff that we're facing here, and we're speaking with Shahid Batar, Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and ultimately we're talking about what will our liberties look like, right, if we don't mobilize in our local communities and then take from the micro to the macro and back again and build these alliances where we have people. Even if there may be disagreements, we're talking about the most fundamental principles of our society here.
And they should unite people regardless of our disagreements. That coalition in Utah I mentioned, one reason I'm so excited by it is that, you know, libertarians and environmentalists in Utah haven't found common cause on environmental policy. They haven't found common cause on tar sands. They haven't found common cause on any number of things. But they've found common cause on the NSA. Right. And that's the issue here, is that if we come together and focus on our points of consensus, our most fundamental interests, the mere opportunity to raise our voices about whatever else we might believe down the road, we can not only hold the line, but gain ground in terms of recovering not only the individual privacy, but the robust civil society it's meant to protect. It's a way for us to gain access to the information, for instance, that's long been hidden from us. You know, I could think of the Freedom of Information Act as a mm-hmm. perfect example here. You know, it was secured through grassroots mobilization, and its most recent revisions were to narrow it in the face of CIA crimes. Again, by a bipartisan establishment, insulating itself in that case from judicial order, saying you have to release evidence of detainee torture. And where did that lead? To a fight between the Senate Intelligence Committee and the CIA, going on still to this day, right, where, you know, there's a 6,000-page report on CIA torture no one's seen.
Which is apparently what caught Dianne Feinstein's attention, right, with that, oh, they're spying on me too.
Yep.
It almost is like the recent quote-unquote revelations of hackers getting into celebrities' phones and putting their nude pictures out on the internet, obviously violating privacy among various other things. And there's been a lot of outrage and contention and discussion about that, right, online. The NSA has been able to do that forever.
For years. And you're paying with it for your tax dollars.
Yeah. So I would love to see that that kind of outrage matched in the population.
Likewise.
Where this is going on everywhere.
Let's be clear, it's no less outrageous. I mean, one of the cutesy terms that apparently is bandied about in the intelligence community is loveint. You know, there's SIGINT, signal intelligence, human intelligence when you infiltrate groups. Loveint is when NSA agents or contractors use the government's terribly powerful tools to basically stalk their ex-lovers. And that's incredibly gross. It's not just a privacy violation. It's not just a freedom of thought violation. We're talking about domestic violence implications on top of this, all enabled by what? The same culture of secrecy and institutional deference right. and corruption that enables these things to happen in the first instance. We touched on briefly the CIA torture report, and I do just want to take 15 seconds to explain for your listeners exactly what has happened here. The CIA committed grave international human rights offenses, violating statutes and treaties that we fought World War II to establish. It then covered up those crimes, obstructing justice by destroying videotapes. It then spied on the Senate to prevent and impede an investigation into those torture crimes, stole documents from the Senate, filed false claims with the Justice Department seeking prosecution of the Senate staffers investigating the CIA crimes, lied about whether or not any of that happened, and then now is walking around saying, okay, well, the report that you wrote, we only want to release these key pieces, and they're doing that to protect the CIA personnel who violated not only the law, not only international treaties, not only our species' most fundamental commitments, but also undermine the national security of the United States and have the blood of U.S. service members on their hands. That's where we are at with the CIA. And this is an agency, of course, that we have to blame for Al-Qaeda because it trained them in the 1980s when they thought that having religious militants would be a good thing. This is an agency we have to blame for police militarization when the CIA
Now we're dealing with ISIS, Al-Qaeda, ISIS. I mean, we're dealing with people that have been trained or armed, again, by the U.S. You know, we've always been at war. Assad the enemy, Assad the ally. You know, for people that are paying attention, it's the patterns, unfortunately, are there.
Shahid, I want to ask a political sociology question. That's my discipline.
Okay. And, might be over my head, but I'll take my best crack at it.
Well, no, I think you're right there with us here. I mean, historically, C. Wright Mills, power elite, American upper class, dominates decision-making in the country, control. Congress, of course, pays attention to that group of people. You know, so it's a trilateral commission and the Bilderberger groups, and it's international now today. But Peter Dale Scott uses the terminology deep state, and he implies that the deep state, the apparatus of the intelligence agencies and that, which are hidden from public view, are in service to the upper class, transnational class. You're implying here that, in a way, they've gone rogue, that they're even beyond that, that Obama doesn't really tell NSA what to do. They're basically, in many ways, laying out patterns, and there's a give and take, but certainly the power has become entrenched inside of these bureaucracies of deep state politics that have an unrelenting, basically, control. Certainly, Peter Dale would talk about the Kennedy assassination as maybe the turning point there.
Yep.
How do you see all of that?
Yeah, I just use a one-word answer that we could expound upon, but Hoover.
Yeah.
Right?
FBI, right?
The politicization of the intelligence agencies and their propensity to protect their own interests rather than the interests of the country is well established. You know, the FBI has been violating
from the Palmer
rights
raids
for 100 years.
From the Palmer raids forward, the end of World War I. I mean, that's been common. In fact, that was the M.O., really.
In my song, NSA versus USA, I have a verse. It says, for 100 years since World War I, the FBI versus free speech has held the gun. And that's been the M.O. You know, don't even talk about the COINTELPRO era, right? I mean, we have some of our nation's most lauded political heroes who were targets not only of government surveillance, but plots to get them killed.
Including Martin Luther King. Exactly.
Precisely who I mean to say, right? And I think it's this is a history that not enough Americans know. It's revealing how that even came to Congress's attention in the first place. How did that happen? Because a bunch of Vietnam War resistors broke into an FBI office outside Philly. How is that going to happen today? That's not ever happening again.
Yeah.
And if it takes anti-war activists breaking into FBI offices to alert Congress to what was happening then, or an Edward Snowden to alert Congress to what is happening
Chelsea
now.
Chelsea Manning.
Right?
Exactly. Thomas Drake. I mean, the names go on and on. Shahid Batar, Executive Director, Bill of Rights Defense Committee. I'm afraid we're out of time.
Thanks for having me on,
you guys. We'll definitely have you back for another segment. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Shahid Batar, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on. Keep up the great work.
Stick around, folks. After this musical break, we'll talk to Robbie Martin of Media Roots about his film, American Anthrax. We'll be right back. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Our final guest for the program is Robbie Martin, a producer and independent journalist with media roots, also a filmmaker, among many, many, many other things. Also, the film we're going to talk with Robbie Martin about today is American Anthrax. But Robbie, welcome to the Project Censored Show. It's great to have you on.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Another time we're going to have you on to talk all about Media Roots, mediaroots.org, really the work you do with Abby Martin, your sister, who also is at RT, breaking the set, so on. So there's a lot of things we could talk about. But today, we're dealing with the 9/11 Film Festival. You're going to be part of that. Let's hear a little bit about the film that you put together about, well, one of those down the memory hole subjects, right, surrounding 9/11, that being the anthrax attacks, media coverage, and sort of the disappearance of that story.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was an event that happened immediately after 9/11 that most people, I think, have forgotten about over time, just because obviously 9/11 sort of eclipsed it. And it was sort of in the mixture of a lot of other things that followed 9/11, like the DC sniper attacks, the Richard Reed shoe bombings. So in all that stuff, in that mixture, it of course kind of gets lost. But, you know, a couple of journalists, including Glenn Greenwald, I think it was around the time when Bruce Ivins died, which was the main anthrax suspect, they pointed out to me that there was actually some Iraq war propaganda that was sort of shoehorned into the anthrax attacks, trying to connect Saddam Hussein to the anthrax attacks, essentially. And one particularly damning story was ABC News ran a report where they claimed they had government sources that essentially had proof that the anthrax came from Saddam Hussein because of this telltale sign of what they referred to as bentonite, which is some kind of, you know, cohering agent or something that would help the anthrax bond together better. But it turned out that was completely made up. And, you know, the damage at that point had already been done, since that sort of already went out. And those seeds are planted. Once they're planted, you know, people remember that once they started to really push for the Iraq war.
So anthrax was mailed to the Capitol. It was mailed to a number of people. Some people died, including some of the journalists who had written about Bush's daughters. And what do we know at this point about the validity? I mean, and then, of course, it was implied that Al-Qaeda was behind it, and now we know that that couldn't possibly have been true.
Yeah.
So where do we stand? I mean, what's the overall situation? What's the main point of your film?
The film itself has no narration. So it's sort of open to interpretation if you're watching it without really knowing much about the anthrax attacks. But I wanted to leave viewers with the impression, at least, that Bruce Ivins, the culprit that they're trying to pin all this on, after they already tried to blame it on Al-Qaeda, then next Iraq, and then even another guy named Stephen Hatfill, after they ended up at this last suspect, he committed suicide, or allegedly committed suicide, before they were able to bring any criminal charges whatsoever to him. So in the end, it just seems like an awfully convenient way for them to tie everything up nice and neat and just say, oh yeah, this is the guy, but he's dead, so.
And the FBI closed the case at that juncture.
Oh yeah, they actually closed the case. What they did was they passed it to a government body called the National Academy of Sciences while they were still working on the case. And this body was supposed to actually examine all the DNA evidence that the FBI provided. Basically, the FBI's smoking gun at the end of it all was they claimed that Bruce Ivins had a flask of anthrax spores that matched the anthrax spores found in the letters that were sent to these people. But this government body, the National Academy of Sciences, determined that there was no DNA match, that essentially it was impossible to trace back the anthrax sent in the letters. And this opens up a whole sort of new angle to it that I didn't really explore in my movie, but essentially the National Academy of Sciences was saying that this anthrax that was in the letters was actually a specialized kind of weaponized anthrax that would mutate on its own, making the DNA basically unmatchable, even regardless if it had, you know, it would have matched. The anthrax essentially was designed to mutate on its own and make it untraceable, basically.
So this was kind of like a Lee Harvey Oswald conclusion, then, is that, I mean, Bruce Ivins dies, okay, he was the guilty one, it was a single crazy scientist who sent these out, and that's that. That's kind of where it stands.
Oh, yeah.
And you're saying that that's just not possible.
Yeah, I mean, the National Academy of Sciences is saying that the FBI's evidence is bunk. That's one reason why it's not possible. And then also, all of Bruce Ivins' colleagues and coworkers and his family members have contradicted most of the things the FBI has said about him. And this is the interesting thing, is the best evidence the FBI was able to provide to, like, show the public that Bruce Ivins was behind it was a series of emails he wrote years and years ago talking about how upset he was about 9/11, how terrorists might use anthrax, and these kind of things, which were obviously cherry-picked over like a decade of his emails. But if you think about it, if they're able to access all of his private emails, that's essentially the best evidence that they could come up with, which is not really very good. You know, and emails of him talking about how he was depressed at different times in his life, and I mean, that's not really evidence at all.
And it's also the case that Barack Obama threatened to veto any investigation that would reopen. Is that, I saw that you had written that at Media Roots.
Yeah, he this is like off record. Apparently a White House employee who left the White House a couple months after the Bruce Ivins death. All right, because actually the death happened at a point where the administrations were transitioning, which is another sort of convenient thing to happen, is Bruce Ivins dies right at the end of the Bush administration. Obama takes over, and then a White House employee went on record saying that Obama threatened to veto any funding or essentially block any funding for any new investigation into it. And a few Congress members have tried to bring it up again and raise the issue, but they just kind of got ignored. Russ Holt was one of them.
The people in Congress, Leahy and others, were they targeted for political purposes, do you think? And, of course, the authors or the journalists down in Florida.
Absolutely, I think they were. The two journalists that were targeted were Tom Brokaw and just a general letter to the New York Post. There was another journalist that actually died, and I'm not sure how he ended up dying from anthrax, but that's one of the people that died. But a lot of people have speculated, and it seems pretty valid, because Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy were both very strong critics of the Patriot Act. They made several statements early on, because keep in mind, the Patriot Act was being pushed through and fast-tracked through Congress around the exact same time the anthrax attacks were going on. And yeah, they were two of the most vocal critics against it. And I mean, you know, if you want to get
people... Of course, a massive bill, the Patriot Act, that had been pre-written.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, Robbie Martin, unfortunately, we are out of time for the hour on the Project Censored show. We're going to have about another minute here for you to have a conclusive remark. But we'd like to hear, where can people find out more about your work, about Media Roots? And, of course, your film will be shown at the 9/11 Film Festival at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland Thursday, 9/11.
Yeah, you can find out more about the work I do at MediaRoots.org. Abby and I do a podcast pretty regularly called Media Roots Radio. It's sort of a less truncated, more in-depth version of like her show, Breaking the Set, more long-form interviews and stuff like that.
Robbie Martin, thanks so much for the work you do at Media Roots, certainly the work you do with Abby Martin, and thanks so much for coming out to see us. And we invite people next Thursday, 9/11, to come out to the Grand Lake Theater from 1 p.m. to 10 or 11 p.m. That's a long day, but your film will be featured as part of the 9/11 Film Festival, American Anthrax.
Yes.
Thanks so much for joining us. You've been tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillip. Thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. Thanks to Lucretia Burton on the controls. Thanks to Junkyard Empire for the music we want. Welcome, KZYX. In Philo, California, you are the most recent subscriber, so to speak, to the Project Censored Show. We're on almost 20 stations around the U.S. We thank everybody for listening. If you want to learn more about us, go to projectcensored.org. Thanks again, everybody, for tuning in. This is the Project Censored Show. If you want to email us your comments or suggestions for programs, go to projectcensored.org. Follow us on Facebook at Project Censored. In a world without oppressive forces, slaving for almighty dollar bills.